This is episode 14 of The Living Reminders with Mary and Blake.
2% doesn't sound like much. But 2% of the entire planet, of every person on it, that's more than the world's 10 largest cities combined. It's 140 million people. And like that, they were gone.
All the way from Providence, Rhode Island, welcome to The Living Reminders. It's a podcast dedicated to the show The Leftovers on HBO. We're still here, and so are you. So let's chat with Tom Parada. Suddenly I'm hidden. It's the darkness of the dawn. And your friends are gone. I'm your host, Mary Larson.
My name is Blake. And I literally got chills, as you said. Let's chat with Tom Parada.
I was smiling.
Oh my God. Smiling's my favorite.
It actually is. For those of you who don't know, I'm pretty much a Christmas elf who watches The Leftovers. Like the saddest show ever, and I'm like the happiest person ever. Talk about it.
Oh my God. So for those of you who don't know, I don't know how you don't know, but if you don't know, Tom Parada, he's kind of a big deal.
He wrote the book, The Leftovers.
And he is the creator of our favorite HBO television show.
So we got to meet with him because today...
Well, we didn't meet him. We got a chance to talk with him.
Yeah, over the phone. I feel like that's meeting. It's better than like texting, you know?
Better than emailing.
Yeah. You get to hear someone's voice, get to chat.
Is it better than faxing?
Oh, God. Wait, who faxes? Who faxes? Well, today is a very special day, and that is why you have a very special interview.
Yes, happy Departure Day.
Can you actually say happy?
Yeah, would you say happy? Or be like, hey, sucky Departure Day.
Yeah, I feel like... I think it's Yom Kippur. It's actually coming up this month, too. It's that... that holiday, I don't even know if they can call it a holiday. I don't even know what it is, but in Jewish tradition where you repent your sins, so it's not like happy. You don't say like, hey, happy Yom Kippur.
Well, they did call it Heroes Day in the show. So can we call it Heroes Day here?
No, because Tom called it Departure Day.
Okay, so yeah, it would be. So, hey, you can't
let's
say happy.
Let's remember Departure Day.
We're
That's
still
what
here.
Say. We're still here, and so are you.
So we're remembering Departure Day, October 14th. And for you, our listeners, we got Tom Parada to come on the show. So, you know what? Let enough of us talk in and you know what? Let's just get to what everybody wants to hear. Let's hear Mr. Parada talk. What do you think?
Good.
Let's do it.
Joining us now is Tom Parada, a screenwriter, Academy Award nominee, and author of novels such as Election and Little Children. The New York Times has dubbed Tom as an American Chekhov, whose characters, even at their most ridiculous, seem blessed and ennobled by a luminous human aura. But we all know him as the author, co-creator, and co-executive producer of our favorite show on HBO, The Leftovers. Tom, thank you so much for joining us here on The Living Reminders.
Yo, thanks for having me.
Now, you have a pretty wide variety of novels that deal with a number of different subjects. So, with this in mind, what was your inspiration for The Leftovers?
There were a couple things. The first thing to say is I just got very interested in the rapture, and the Christian concept of the rapture. I've been doing, my last book was about the culture war between evangelicals and secular liberals. And so in the course of writing that book, The Abstinence Teacher, I sort of read a lot about the rapture and started thinking about it. And I went from, you know, having a kind of very skeptical and somewhat maybe satirical view of it to for some reason just trying to take it seriously. And it just stuck in my head as a kind of really interesting scenario. And it seemed to fit my own way of writing. I write sort of suburban, domestic novels about ordinary Americans, and it seemed to me the opposite of apocalyptic stories that involve zombies or nuclear wars. And it just struck me that I could write the least apocalyptic story that was out there. Because it's obviously a time when people are really obsessed with the apocalypse as a storytelling device. And so I thought I could put an interesting twist on it, and one that fit my own style of writing.
Well, I love the choice that you made by having it focus on the people that were, you know, literally left over. You know, a lot of the movies, as like you said, as of late, have succumbed to this this detriment of like, oh my God, the world's going to end. We have this one person that can save us, or there's a chosen one, or if you don't do X, Y, or Z, the world's going to blow up. And you totally went the opposite way, and it was extremely refreshing. I just wanted to say that.
The other thing is that for me, you know, it struck me as being a really beautiful metaphor for a kind of loss that almost everybody suffers at some point in their life, you know, which is, I think it's a particular kind of grief that you feel when somebody just is here one minute and gone the next. You know, it's a terrible thing when someone's sick and it takes them a long time to die. And that's really hard on everybody. But it's somehow a different kind of wound when somebody dies in an accident or some kind of violent act, or, you know, they just suffer a heart attack and they die. You know, when you're not prepared for that loss, when somebody's here one second and gone the next, that's a particular awful kind of loss, and the rapture is a kind of metaphor for that. They just seem to have disappeared from the world.
Yeah, no, I really related to your book a lot, because just quick aside, my mom passed away very, very suddenly when I was 18, and I didn't have time to grieve or anything like that, because everything just moved so quickly. And I remember in the show, you know, the Reverend Matt was saying of Meg that, you know, her grief was hijacked by the departure. And I really ended up feeling the same a lot. And that's why I could really connect to your novel and to your book. I thought it was great. But we actually interviewed Kath Lingenfelter, one of the writers on your show, and she talked about her loss and her grief and how she dealt with her parents and everything. She opened up to us a lot. And she was going over that with Damon Lindelof and when she got the job. So Damon Lindelof and you have created this show, and Damon is serving as the showrunner. Can you talk to us about how that came about and what happened and how the show got designed and everything?
Yeah, sure. You know, when I was writing the book, it really struck me that it was too big a story to fit into the space of a feature film. And beyond that, you know, I was really... like you guys and like a lot of other people right now, I feel like there's just this huge energy around TV. There's just, you know, amazing stories being told. And it struck me that The Leftovers had the potential to be a good TV show. And so, of course, I thought, well, let's try HBO. That's the, you know, they're the ones who kind of created this, you know, revolution in long-form TV. So I said, my agent sent the book to HBO, and they were very receptive to it. So I went in and met, and what we had agreed before the meeting was that we would talk about potential showrunners, because I don't, you know, I'm a novelist, not a TV producer, and I kind of knew, like, don't put this in my hands. I wouldn't really know how to make the show. So they said, why don't you make a list of, you know, possible showrunners, and we'll make a list of possible showrunners. And I swear this is true. We both had Damon at the top of our list. And so it was really a very simple decision. They said, well, let's talk to him about it. And, you know, amazingly enough, you know, he was also really excited about the idea. We just had to wait a while because he was under contract, with ABC. And then he and I just started, talking about, you know, what kind of show we wanted to make. And, you know, we wrote a draft of the pilot, and we, got feedback from HBO, and, you know, things evolved, but it was actually a pretty straightforward process, considering how long it sometimes takes to get from book to screen. It took us 2 years from the day we met to the day that we went into production on the pilot.
Talk about that timeline a little bit. Was that like shortly after Lost had ended, or was that something that happened a little bit after that?
Lost, it may have been a couple of years, but he had, you'll have to ask him about the details of it. All I know is that he was still under contract to them.
Okay. And it's great that you guys, both you and HBO, picked Damon Lindelof, because, some could argue that he is, he gave birth to this new golden age of TV with Lost. So it's amazing that you guys could come to an agreement on that. And especially with this kind of storytelling that you created with The Leftovers.
It was very interesting. I think we come from different ends of the storytelling world. I was sort of a literary fiction writer, and Damon comes out of this sort of pop culture world of sci-fi and comic books, and obviously in TV. But it turned out we had a lot in common. We grew up pretty close to each other in New Jersey, and we read a lot of the same stuff, and our storytelling instincts turned out to be pretty close. And I definitely felt like I was learning a lot from him too. So, it was a very good collaboration in that way.
Yeah, sounds like a great relationship. Now, along with Damon, you both wrote episodes 1, 5, and 10. So I wanted to know what the difference for you was between writing books and writing for episodic television.
It couldn't be bigger. I mean, it's just an entirely different process. I mean, when I'm writing a book, it's just me, and every word is mine, and every decision is mine. So it's a very pure expression of my sensibility and my style. And writing for TV is just it's just the complete opposite. It's enormously collaborative. The pilot Damon and I wrote together. There was just two of us, so that was maybe a little closer to my normal work style, but still, to add one other person is changed the whole dynamic of the process. But then in the room there were 6 or 7 of us, and what you have is just this sort of long conversation, several days long conversation, where you're going through the script line by line and beat by beat, and evaluating everybody's ideas and trying to agree on, what we think is best. And, not everybody always agrees. And so you have to have a kind of consensus. And it can be a kind of nerve-wracking process, but it's also kind of wonderful, because you have people coming up with ideas that just, I had obviously created the basic concept and the characters, et cetera, but people would come up with ideas like the loved one, say, that, had never occurred to me in writing the book. And it turned out to be just a hugely fertile, addition to the story. So, I guess the metaphor I always use is it's the difference between being like a solo artist, going out and singing his songs with a guitar and joining a band. And just, being playing rhythm guitar. But there's something great about having all that help and all those other visions, enhancing your story.
I know it's totally off base, but I just watched Saving Mr. Banks, the story about the author who wrote Mary Poppins and how Walt Disney made into a movie. And I honestly just saw it this weekend, knowing that we were going to be interviewing you. And of course, you are nothing like the character who wrote that book. But she was saying, this is my family, and I thought this up, and I thought the buildings would be different. And just the struggle that she had in the beginning, I understand what you're saying. I'm a musician, actually, so you're right, versus playing just by yourself and then having a whole ensemble to work with. But I think that it's great that you were able to admire these other people as well, who saw things that you didn't get to see because you hadn't worked necessarily on those bits before. So that's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, it helped that I was a veteran screenwriter, because I have had time to kind of absorb the whole sort of ethos of collaboration, which is, it just doesn't make sense to go in as and say, like, oh, I'm here to collaborate, but by the way, this is mine. Mm-hmm. That just doesn't make any sense. So I think as a writer, you have two choices. One choice is just to step aside and say, you know, here's my book, adapt it. And that's a perfectly reasonable choice. That's what happened for me with Election when that became a film. I didn't have anything to do with the script or the movie. With Little Children, I wrote the script with Todd Field. And that was, really exciting for me to actually work with a director and sort of be part of that collaborative process. But I just don't think it makes sense. And with The Leftovers, I really wanted to be part of it on a day-to-day way. But I also didn't want to be an obstacle. You know, I wanted to be part of the collaborative mix. So that was just a choice I made and something that I was prepared for because I'd spent time collaborating in the past.
Speaking of that collaboration, what's your favorite change the show has made in comparison to your book? You know, like Kevin's occupation or Amanda Warren's character as the mayor or even Nora and Reverend Matt being related?
I mentioned the loved ones before. I thought that was kind of an amazing addition and one that, you know, reverberated throughout the show. I really loved Nora's job with the Department of Sudden Departure. I thought that was kind of ingenious, you know, because in the book, Nora is just basically a kind of separate character. She's really off on her own. She's just trying to get through the day. She watches SpongeBob and keeps a diary that helps her to remember her kids. And she rides her bike a lot to just sort of get out of her own head. And, you know, we realized talking about her that's not a very dramatic occupation for a character, you know. And so I think Damon came up with this idea of the questionnaire for the department at the sudden departure. And it's just a small idea. What seems like a small idea, it turns out to have all these amazing kind of repercussions within the story. So those two, I think, and Nora's job and the loved ones were two of my really favorite additions to the show. I love Amanda Warren as the mayor as well. I think that was, she's filling the space that Kevin used to fill there, but she's such a wonderful actor, and the character of Lucy is, I think, really wonderful too.
Well, speaking about characters, when you were writing them and now being able to look at the show, which actor is closest to what you had in mind when you were writing in terms of look and performance?
Yeah, you know, that was it's an interesting question because I don't often really visualize the characters when I'm writing. It's just something, I don't know what's in my head exactly. And you'll notice if you read my book, that I don't spend a lot of time on physical description. You know, characters kind of, I don't know what I see in my head. Maybe people I used to know, but they're just made of words. But the character in the show who comes closest to, who's closest, I think, to the version that's in the book is Amy, who's played by Emily Mead, who I think is just such a wonderful actress. And if you read the book I think the show's Amy and the book's Amy are very similar. I think, it's amazing to see a character embodied in a way that, and she just felt instantly familiar to me. And I think she's a wonderful actor and a wonderful character.
Do you have a favorite character to write for, speaking of that? And, you know, do you relate to a character most in between the book or the show? Is it different?
That's sort of interesting. I think that I didn't find any of the characters in the book sort of especially harder than others to write about, and I'm not sure any of them felt easier. I think, you know, Kevin and Nora they're the sort of heart and soul of the book, and they turned out to be the heart and soul of the show as well, and you know, they were always rich characters to investigate.
One of the most beautiful scenes in the show this season is the departure scene at the science fair. So what was the motivation for actually not showing the departure? You know, we looked at other people, but you just alluded to the fact that people disappeared.
Yeah, with that light, it was gorgeous, gorgeous scene when the light goes out. Is that something that you played into?
I think we often felt in discussing the departure that, basically the idea is someone is there 1 second and they're gone the next. And it's the kind of thing that we're used to in photography. It's kind of a simple editing trick. I don't think we ever felt like to look at it head on was to get at the truth of it, you know, because if something like that happens to you, I imagine, all that you experience is like, you know, a moment of confusion. It's really the aftermath of that confusion when you realize that person actually is gone. That's what matters. And I think it's what the show does too. It isn't about, you know, the disappearance. It's about the witnesses. So I think you're right to say it's almost like looking at the sun or something. It's too much. And so we show the people who see it. We show the light bulb going out. You kind of just get the surrounding truth rather than the kernel.
So with that in mind too, in witnesses and that confusion, mass confusion and fear, feeling it all at the same time, that reminds me of the Guilty Remnant. And these people were scared, I think. And I think that they were confused and they didn't know what to do other than remember what happened. They're trying to make everybody else remember because I think that's the only option that they felt they had. So with that in mind, we have Patty and Gladys who sacrificed themselves in the show. Is this something that's part of the GR's Guilty Remnant's endgame? And if there is an endgame, is there one or is there not one?
I think it's important to remember that only 3 years have passed from the moment of the departure. And that seemed like a really interesting interlude of time to me, because it's enough that, the event has sort of receded into the past a little bit. But in terms of the history of a religion, that's nothing. And in fact, you know, it took sort of hundreds of years before, you know, Christianity sort of codified itself and people understood what it was they meant when they talked about Christianity. Because the early Christians thought Jesus was going to come back any day. And after, you know, the disciples died and a couple generations went by, people sort of realized, uh-oh, the second coming that he foretold may not happen anytime soon. And the religion had to kind of reconfigure itself. And you know, religions continue to redefine themselves and change their doctrines. And so to me, the Guilty Remnant is a religion in the earliest stages. Meaning they don't really know what they believe yet. They know that it feels good to wear white. They know that they set themselves apart by smoking. They know that it's important that they not talk, because the one thing they do believe is that there's nothing that they can say to explain this event. And because there's nothing they can say to explain this event, there's nothing worth talking about. And so I think they have a few basic ideas. But to me, it's like religion always begins with action rather than doctrine. And I think that, they're improvising to some degree. And somebody like Patty is a kind of a genius improviser. And maybe 50 years from now, somebody will sit down and write the scriptures of the GR, but they haven't been written yet. So I don't think they have an end game. I think they just have a lifestyle that feels right to them in the wake of this event that was so traumatizing.
Is sacrifice a part of that lifestyle, do you think?
I think that in the book especially, the word martyr and martyrdom appears over and over again. That's obviously something that is a huge part of ancient religions, and it's a huge part of some contemporary religions. This idea that you're willing to die to achieve some kind of religious goal or some kind of personal, to get some kind of personal reward, that's a familiar one. They're borrowing from other religions, you know, with their vow of silence, for instance, or with their clothes that set them apart from the rest of the community, and they're borrowing the concept of martyrdom. You know, in the book, it's the GR is just furious with the way that the world seems to be moving forward and forgetting this thing that happened, and so they just keep upping the ante to kind of make sure that people don't fall into this kind of sense that we're moving on, we're healing, it's getting better. They just really want to jolt people awake. And you know, I think it's just interesting, you know, toward the end of the show, actually in the finale, right, Patty's screaming, "Wake up," at Kevin. You know, that's part of the guilty remnant. They're always just trying to shock people into a kind of alertness that is also, you know, an uncomfortable alertness.
Well, I'm going to change gears on you, Tom, for a second. All right. So there's many questions that are not supposed to be answered and that people are left with.
And we respect that, by
yes.
the way.
However, there is one question. During the episode, The Garvey's at Their Best, Kevin goes for a jog, a very memorable jog, because he's walking in these sweatpants. It was a little distracting. I'm just going to say, Justin Theroux, jogging in sweatpants, distracted a lot of people, myself included. Anyway, when he takes a break and he's smoking a cigarette, these ladies come up in a car and they're like, "Hey, you ready?
Are you ready?" Yeah.
And he doesn't know what they're talking about. And they drove away. So can you please shed some light on that? Can you answer that question a little bit? What the heck went on?
Well, you know, I think this is something that I think that different writers had different opinions about. You know, to me, my impulse was always that the departure just happened on a very ordinary day, and that was the real horror and power of it, that just on an ordinary day, you know, the world changed in a kind of permanent and shocking way, and it's going to take a long time for people to understand the meaning of this change, et cetera. I think Damon was very interested in the idea that that there were sort of tremors happening around it for people who were tuned in. So, for instance, you know, Patty, when she's in therapy with Lori, she's claiming that the world's going to end. Now, interestingly, Lori says, "Well, you've said that before," you know. So it's unclear whether or not Patty is just constantly feeling the world's going to end, and that day it does. So, you know, I think the show really thrived on that kind of ambiguity. Is Patty foretelling the departure, or is she just happens to be right in the way that a stop clock is right twice a day? And I think this car with four riders in it is something similar. It's either just the kind of random thing that happens to anybody on any day, and we just forget things. But because something terrible happened right after, it suddenly seems symbolic. Now, I noticed that some people were speculating that this was somehow these people were maybe some early cell of the guilty remnant, which I don't think is the case. I think that if we had any sort of symbolic thing, was it that were they possibly the, you know, the four horse people of the apocalypse. Were they a harbinger of the apocalypse? You know,
it's because they were in white. That's why. They were in light colors, but that's good. That's good to know.
Yeah, so I think the idea from my perspective is that all kinds of things happen every day that would seem symbolic if something terrible happened right after them. There's something about a terrible event that leads everyone to kind of go back to the events immediately preceding it, and they want to see something meaningful. So I say a random thing happened to Kevin, and you can say this ominous thing happened to Kevin, which is that these people were somehow harbingers of the apocalypse, and they came to him. And I think that the show will, maybe someday it will be explained further. I'm not sure, but to me, it's like I'm very interested in the way that huge events create this sort of pressure to find meaning around them.
That episode, The Garveys at the Best, it blew my doors off, and I think it blew a lot of people's doors off. But for you, of all the great episodes you've put out this season so far, do you have a favorite?
Yeah, I just loved Guest, episode number 6, about Nora going to the drop conference. I thought that was just an extraordinary episode of television, and I thought that her meeting with Holy Wayne, again, that's the kind of thing that didn't happen in the book. Holy Wayne was completely separate from Kevin and Nora, and the fact that the show found a way to bring the two of them together and to show what I thought was unshowable, which was, you know, Wayne's power, just I thought was mind-blowing and it was really deeply moving.
I love when she asked him, "Will I forget them?" And Wayne replied,
"Oh, I know."
Oh, and Carrie Coon, she was a revelation for this show. As a matter of fact, I just saw her on Gone Girl, and she oh my God, you guys have a find in her, in her representation of Nora. I couldn't see her in Gone Girl without totally seeing her as Nora, and it was, oh man, she is awesome, right?
Oh my God, yeah. Well, you know, Damon and I saw her audition tape where she read the speech that she gives in the pilot. And, you know, it was just her in front of a camera. And I, you know, I have to say, I saw it a couple times and it would make me cry. You know, just there was so much emotion right there, right away. And we just both said, there's Nora. I mean, it really was just, it just went right to the gut.
So, Tom, after this first season, there are a lot of people that just love this show. Our listeners are among that group, and they're diehard listeners. They want to come to us and listen to us every week, and they just want more and more and more. We've asked every person that we've interviewed this same question, and I'm really interested to hear what you have to say about this, which is, what do you want us as viewers to feel after we've watched that first season or a particular episode?
I guess, you know, I understand why you asked that question. And you know, I don't think there's a single simple answer from my perspective. You know, we wanted to, you know, provoke people. We wanted to make them think. We wanted to scare them. We wanted to make them cry. We wanted to make them appreciate the people in their lives. And we wanted them to care about these characters. So I it never struck me that I was going for one particular thing, or that we were going for one particular feeling. I think the show did inspire a lot of sadness, but also a lot of wonder. You know, I think it was a kind of, there were moments that felt kind of magical and deeply moving. And complicated. And I think it was a show that really made people think about the meaning of life. And it's a pretty big subject, you know. But if you were willing to kind of follow the show down that dark path that it followed, I think you would start to think about some pretty deep questions about why we're here and what it all means, it's kind of a very ambitious thing for a TV show to want to do. But I think if you were receptive to the show, that would be the outcome.
With that dark path in mind, when we interviewed Kathleen Infelter, she had posited that the show ultimately it was about confronting grief and confronting yourself, your own existence. But in the end, it was about hope. Do you think you would agree with that?
And it's okay if you don't. It's okay if you don't.
I think just any kind of storytelling is an act of hope, even kind of really dark storytelling. I think we ended on a moment of hope, which is basically hope that people can still connect, and that you know, the meaning of life is in connection among people. I do think there is that hope. But I mean, you know, for some other characters, hope is something much bigger, which is, you know, in that traditional apocalyptic narrative, is there someone or something who can make the world right? You know, I think there's that level of hope. I don't think that gets fulfilled in the story, but this other more everyday hope, which is that we can find people to love and be loved by, that is the kind of hope that you're left with, I think, in the show. And that's the kind of hope that seems more real to me.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. That was honestly, couldn't have asked for a better answer to that question. And it has been such a delight having you here on the podcast, The Living Reminders with Blake and I. So thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it. And it, of course, is tomorrow will be October 14th, the day of the departure.
I know.
All right, Tom. Thank you so much. It was an absolute honor, like I've already said. And hopefully we'll be able to talk to you again soon. Hopefully we can arrange that.
Do you eat like a piece of cake on October 14th? What do you do?
No, I look in my refrigerator and there's nothing there.
Oh, no. Well, Tom, thank you so much once again. And we may talk to you again in the future. Who knows, my friend?
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.
Oh, wow. That guy's cool.
He is super cool. Like, he is freaking... Oh, my God. Just to... Like, I'm sad that we only got a half hour with him. Because I could literally sit and pick his brain all day long, right? And just talk with him about The Leftovers. Like, that whole thing with the ladies in the car, you know? And he's like, yeah, you know, it's important, but it's not...
Could also not be important.
Yeah, it's not exactly what people are making it out to be. He's like, you know, he's saying that he doesn't really think that they're from the GR. You know, they're important people, but they're only really ominous, more so than anything else.
It reminded me of a fortune cookie. Like, you know, when you open a fortune cookie, just roll with me on this. You know, okay, when you open a fortune cookie and it says, like, your next adventure will be one of your greatest of all?
Uh-huh.
It could. It also could not.
Yeah, it could also really suck.
You know, or it could say the next decision you make is very important. It could. Or it could be like paying for the check. Maybe you pay for your check and because of that, you meet your true love up at the checkout counter. You don't know. Or it could just be nothing. So when he said that, I thought of fortune cookies.
Well, the thing I can't believe you actually brought up was Justin Theroux's package.
He left, which means he noticed it too. I didn't know if he was going to sit there because he's a dude, and I didn't know if he'd be like, what are you talking about? But he laughed because I was trying to, I didn't say package. I wasn't like, wow, I was really distracted by all that swinging and bumping around. I just said Justin Theroux running in sweatpants, and
you
I alluded
said swinging and bumping around.
I could have said that to Tom Perotta, and I didn't.
I'm glad that you didn't, because we would have to apologize to him just like we apologized to Kath Lingenfelter for calling her masterpiece story Twilight.
Anyway, so, but Tom got it, which, as I said,
I was really happy about that. That was actually really cool.
Makes you wonder, like, when they had their next powwow, you know, where all the writers get together and they say, okay, what are we going to do for the next episode? Did they go and they said, guys, you know, it was the thing that everyone talked about on Twitter wasn't about XYZ.
Yeah.
It was about Justin Theroux's package. Wow.
They're probably like, hey, dude, you know what? Next time wear four pairs of underwear, not two.
Tape that.
Where's the duct tape?
Oh, man. Yeah, but that was a lot of fun.
No, that was absolutely awesome. And guys, this is all for you. And for a couple of things, actually three things I want to do. First, I want to give a lot of thanks to Dylan Shuck over at the Guilty Remnant podcast. He helped me out with some of these questions.
Thank you, Dylan.
And I also want to give some really good thanks to our friend of the show, Brian. He also helped us out with these questions. So I was nervous about
Brian.
Thank you, Brian. We wanted to make sure we got everything correct, and we didn't want to mess it up.
We also need to thank one of the most important people of the night. Who? Our friend Eric.
Oh, yes.
Because our child, he's 18 months and he's crazy right now, and he doesn't be quiet ever. And we asked our friend Eric, we were like, if we buy you a steak and cheese sandwich, will you help our kid watch Mickey Mouse and not scream during the interview? And he did. So that is why you didn't hear any crying this episode.
Exactly, which is
sometimes
great.
You hear crying because the kid wakes up. You didn't hear it this time. Thank you, Eric.
And the last person I want to give a lot of thanks to was actually kind of the catalyst to this interview, which is our super fan, super awesome listener, Missy Ortiz. You lit a fire under my butt when you realized that October 14th was coming up. And as soon as you did that and you kind of challenged us to do something special, this came about.
And we took that idea and we ran with it.
We ran with it, and it wouldn't have been possible without you. So thank you, Missy. You really knocked it out of the park for us, and this is all really a lot of thanks to you. So.
All right, kid, what do you say we close out this fantastic show that we've had today? All right, let's get it done. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening today. We really appreciate it.
Enjoy Departure Day
with
your ones who are still with you. I think that that's what you need to take out of Departure Day. You know, go and hug someone, call someone you haven't spoke to a while.
Yeah, because, you know, even Tom said it, too. He's like, you know, you should be thankful for what you got. Remember who is around you, you know, and confront that and accept it and move on with it. And I think that's probably what Departure Day is all about.
But don't just move on. Enjoy it. Go out. Like, you know what tomorrow is, or today is?
What?
Departure Day. Today is stop and get yourself that iced coffee as a treat.
Yes.
Give a tip to the coffee girl. Call your mom on the way to work.
Yep.
You know, call your friend who you haven't talked to forever because she had a kid and now she doesn't have a life. Me. You know.
Or the husband. Me.
Yeah. You know, just do a little something extra because... God knows, if something like this ever happened to us, we'd sit here and we'd be like, remember that girl Mary? She told me to be nice and call people, and I missed my opportunity. Who knows? Departure Day could happen October 15th, guys. I'm just saying.
It could happen. It could happen today, October 14th. You never know.
Go live your life. Go hug somebody. Get yourself a special, like one of those caramel iced coffees. You know,
oh, yeah, with like
about.
The extra pumps.
Yeah, do that. And thank you so much for tuning in.
Yeah, awesome. So, guys, thank you. This was an honor to do. It was an honor, like I said, to speak with Tom Perotta. He is the absolute man. And I guess that's another person we have to thank. He was very kind, very willing to do whatever we wanted to do. And he was awesome.
Yeah, and our friends at HBO.
Yes. I thank you, guys, at HBO. You guys
You make
rock.
It all possible.
I know. You guys rock. So, special thanks to Tom Perotta.
Well, everyone, you know where to reach us. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and email. You know us. We're the Living Reminders.
And let me say it. Come on, hold on. Let me say it. You can reach us on the email machine at livingreminders@gmail.com.
Thank you so much for tuning in. to the Living Reminders. I'm Mary.
My name is Blake.
And we'll talk to you all soon.